Turn that guitar up.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the 45th anniversary of one of America's greatest rock and roll bands.
She can't sell walking and all. I'm just a walking, y'all know. Well, if you don't know how to do it, I'll show you how to walk and dog. Dream on, dream on, dream on, dream on.
I mean, you know, look, let's be honest. Being in this band, it's to say that, you know, there's a dream come true to become famous, to have an album out and, you know, get your voice on the, your songs played on the radio, is a real trip. It's a dream come true, you know, in many respects.
The summer of love and the hippies and all that, so you start growing your hair a little long. It was a sign of rebellion. It was like a sign of, you know, I mean, the whole thing about rock and roll, I mean, it was still suffering the rap from the 50s, or the, you know, it being race music and being the devil's music.
We all live on the edge of town, where we all live ain't a soul around.
Hey, this is Joe Perry from Aerosmith. You're in the studio.
Hi, this is Steven Tyler, and you're in the studio with the Bad Boys and Aerosmith.
In retrospect, it's a bit shocking how fully formed the signature Aerosmith sound was on their self-titled January 1973 debut, writes Stephen Thomas Erlewine in the All Music Guide. This album still sounds like a first album, complete with stumbles and haziness that comes with the debut. But despite all this, Aerosmith's first clearly showcases all the attributes of the band that would become the defining American hard rock band of the 70s. They are truly an American band, sounding as though they were the best bar band in your local town, cranking out nasty, hard-edged rock. But the early masterpiece is, of course, Dream On, the first full-fledged power ballad. There was nothing quite like it in 1973, and it remains the blueprint for all power ballads since, end quote. To mark the January 1973 release of their first album, I convened Aerosmith guitarist Joe Perry, bass player Tom Hamilton, and lead singer Steven Tyler, who told me that long before he adopted the stage name Tyler, Steven was swaddled by music in the Tallarico household.
Well, because most people are bitching about how they had lousy childhoods underneath their father or parents' thumb. I literally grew up under the piano. He was a Juilliard graduate and a classical musician all the way, so I got to listen to all those sonatas and Bach and Beethoven and Brahms and Debussy, and it was kind of that's where my passion for music came from, was in the notes. No one had to tell me. I got, you know, I'm Italian here, you know what I'm talking about. Got a lot of hugs and kisses, and I just thought it was interesting to bring that up, you know, because I followed in his footsteps. My father's father, they came over from Italy, as you know, and they, in the 20s and 30s, literally got on a train and would come out to Ohio. I've got this little brochure of them in 1923, getting on a train from New York City, going out to Ohio and playing, you know, as we would do on tour. But the big El Grande hotels back then, you know, chamber music, as it would be, as opposed to Marshall's today. You know, that's what they did, and I guess, you know, they passed that on to me. My father always said, make sure you have something to fall back on, and that's why I strapped a pillow to my ass for so many years. But, you know, I didn't want to be a piano tuner or any of that stuff. My uncle took care of New York, and I just, you know, became a rape and pillage and vagabond in the rock and roll thing. Always did it. We started in New York City because we lived outside of it, and then eventually got out of the club scene because it was four sets a night, ripping my throat apart and going up to Bones Gate at Dartmouth, as Tom Hamilton would say. Dartmouth High School, you know, college. And, you know, for $300 a night as opposed to $175 for four sets. So, you know, it was a good little, you know, going back from where it all came from.
Joe Perry and Tom Hamilton had a band together as teenagers in the summers in New Hampshire, and on a night off, they went to see another band which had come up from New York with a singing drummer, Steven Tallarico, who would alter their lives forever. First Tom Hamilton, then Joe Perry of Aerosmith.
I think a lot of people know that there was this club up in New Hampshire called The Barn, which is where all the bands would play that were good bands. And, you know, there was this one famous band that would come up from New York and play there called The Strangers with this singer, Steven. So Joe and I went over there to, you know, hopefully go and see him, and we couldn't get in. The place was packed, and there was just no way we could get in. And so we sat outside and listened, and it was really amazing. But then I remember another show up at this ski area called King Ridge, and that's when the band was called The Chain Reaction. And they opened with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. They had originals, but they did a lot of other stuff too. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I mean, this guy is incredible, and this probably sounds better than the way the Beatles would do it. It was really amazing. It was like you could really see that, you know, it was a whole level above any of the other bands around there.
Especially ours.
Yeah.
Because Tom and I were playing in a band together. We were, you know, working together and just, you were jamming, but our musical taste tended to, I don't want to, like, put a qualitative, you know, label on anything, but, you know, we were into the MC5 and Fleetwood Mac and the Yardbirds and, you know, like, just loud and raunchy rock and roll, you know, which was our, you know, stock and trade for our little band. Of, you know, we had a drummer, and we would just flail. And of course, Steven's band, you know, it was famous for
stuff
there,
like,
you know.
Train Kept a Rolling. And
yeah, no, you guys did, and that was the common ground. You know, everybody that gets together with a band, you know, with other guys, there's always like one or two songs that hook them in. You know, there's a commonality of taste, at least in one place, and that was where our bands joined. Steven's band played the Yardbirds song, Train Kept a Rolling, and we played it. So, you know, there was that one place where the two spheres or the two orbits met, you know, and and that summer, over a couple of summers, you know, like, we knew him. He would come up, and, you know, like, I remember one summer everybody was all excited because they had a single on the jukebox called The Sun. And it was like, whoa, there's a single. They have a single out. They have a record deal and all that. So, I mean, they were writing their own songs and stuff. They were way ahead of what we were doing. I mean, we were 16 years old, you know. And then one summer, as we talked about in the book, Steven was leaving that band and he needed an audition tape for it. I guess he was going to, like, send a tape to Jeff Beck or something. And we played backup on a song called I'm Down, a Beatles song. And then we started jamming. And then we decided to hook up in New York, or in Boston, you know. And, you know, over a couple of months, Steven decided he wanted to step out from behind the drums and get out in front again, you know.
But even before they formed the band Aerosmith, Steven Tyler had been enticed by a veteran pop music manager to dump his New York bandmates and go solo. As ambitious as he was then, Steven turned it down.
The difference between our bands and the other bands at the time that didn't make it was that we searched out Palisades Park and would play there for free Saturday afternoons. WMCA Good Guy shows with Scott Muni for free at the Jewish Center. And so I got a chance to see what big time was like from small time. I was still on the same stage, even though nobody showed up. You know, I got a sense of what it was like, you know, and a taste for it. Loyalty, yeah. I mean, when you're in a band, it's a real thick, warm overcoat. Because, you know, I went from the Maniacs to the Chain Reaction to the Chain to William Proud to all these different bands. And, you know, it was like, I mean, it was very scary when Joe and Brad left. You know, it brought up abandonment issues from being in bands in the old days. And how hard it is to make it, have anybody show up at all. I remember in the beginning with Aerosmith playing for beer, and nobody showed up, and we would argue with the club owners, what are we playing for? There's nobody here. So yes, back then it was very comforting to know that you were in a band, and I didn't want to be taken, you know, off and brought around and having some background singers and some people, you know, it just didn't feel right.
Aerosmith lead guitarist Joe Perry.
That was kind of traditional in the way bands got together. That you know, like, if there was somebody that you basically were looking for a guitar player or a drummer, or you'd first start talking to them and kind of see where they were at, and if you got along, and if you kind of, you know, had some common interests. And obviously, you talk about music, and then when you got down to it, the more songs that you knew in common defined what kind of taste you had, you know, and kind of put you in the running to kind of join the band, or, you know, have you know, form a band with these other guys. Steven's band was a little more vocal heavy. They had two or three guys that could sing and sing really strong harmony, so they were able to do, they would cover Beatles songs and Steve Miller songs and Bird songs. So they were a little more, you know, able to sing more of that kind of pop harmony driven kind of thing, whereas Tom and I were more into like the crunchy guitar stuff. And you know, to us, singing was just something to take up space between guitar solos.
Dream On was a song that Steven Tyler contributed to the first Aerosmith album in January 1973, but would not become a hit until several years later on its third release as a single. Up next, Tyler, Joe Perry, Tom Hamilton, and I find common ground in a love for British invasion rock and roll. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online 24/7 at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the 45th anniversary of Aerosmith's first album.
Hi, this is Steven Tyler, and you're in the studio with the Bad Boys and Aerosmith.
Hey, this is Joe Perry from Aerosmith. You're in the studio.
Thanks, guys. I'm Redbeard for the anniversary of Aerosmith's January 1973 debut. Providing musical common ground upon which to build Aerosmith were the British invasion bands of the mid-1960s, most significantly the Jeff Beck and later Jimmy Page era Yardbirds. Bass player Tom Hamilton of Aerosmith reminds us that in rural New Hampshire in 1968, it wasn't easy to keep up on the music exploding out of England.
First of all, there was no radio station to listen to be exposed to all kinds of different music, you know. But, you know, the music up there was whatever the summer kids brought up and showed everybody, and, you know, different people who were aware of what was coming over from England, and, you know, Joe coming up from Massachusetts, and that's where a lot of the information came from. So I wasn't really aware of that whole side of it. Plus, back then, that was real top 40. And, you know, it was like you either listened to Top 40 or you listened to underground music. And Top 40 was called bubblegum and, you know, just considered not something to be taken seriously, not cool in that era of the hippies and the, you know, the all these incredible bands like the Yardbirds and the Stones and the Birds and the and Jefferson Airplane and all these incredible bands that were creating this new music. So that was what I was exposed to.
And if you look at the map, New England is pretty darn close to England. You know what I mean? It is. So, you know, we got a lot of that stuff early on. I mean, I remember that Fleetwood Mac, the old, you know, Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, yeah. They would set up and practice at the Tea Party and stay there for weeks. Same bands played there as would play at the Fillmore's and those kind of places, and they would come over. And a lot of bands would start in Boston, you know, like the Jeff Beck Group would start there, and then they would go to New York. They would, you know, kind of like off-Broadway, so to speak, in Boston. And so we got to see all those bands come through right when they'd get off the boat, you know.
Aerosmith lead guitarist Joe Perry tells what musical common ground the five musicians found that they all shared.
I think it was Train Kept a Rollin', the Yardbird song. But the blues in its form, in the English form of the word, you know, the blues that had been already taken and, you know, redefined by the English bands. I mean, I knew people that were like, you know, these blues players. In fact, we had a guy in our band, Tom Hamilton and I had a guy named John McGuire, and he really wanted to play blues. He really wanted to, you know, wear baggy jeans and be barefoot and, you know, just play Howlin' Wolf songs and Muddy Waters songs just the way that they did it, you know. And we basically made a decision. You know, we said, no, we want to wear white capizios and play through big amps and wear tight pants. You know, we want to rock. And at that point, he left and stayed up in the woods up in New Hampshire, and Tom and I went down to Boston to seek our fortunes. So we weren't really like, you know, blues fanatics. I mean, we knew where it came from and we were inspired by it, but we liked the energy and the excitement of the rock. So the song that we had in common was this song called Train Kept a Rollin', which, you're right, it is a blues song. And, you know, as we, you know, kind of learned, you know, who did it, and then we listened back, and it was actually not even a blues song, you know, in the form that that basically the Yardbirds took. You know, if you listen to the Tiny Bradshaw version with all the answer backs and the calling, and it's all, they met a girl and it just had a it was all like kind of swingy and big bandy, and but the blues was definitely this kind of thing underneath it all, and I don't think we realized it at that point how important it was to us.
Another unifying element for the new band members in Aerosmith in those days was long hair. Again, Joe Perry.
Well, it was a symbol that you wore that you know, it symbolized how you thought, really, in that era. I mean, everybody was coming out of that 50s straight thing. I mean, this whole, like, this straight arrow, like, right-wing kind of vibe. Because, you know, coming out of World War II and in the Korean War, everybody was like, you know, there was a common cause going on. And people were, you know, the whole thing about the Vietnam War and Watergate and all that stuff, it was, it really stunk. And people were, you know, rebelling against that. So there was this whole social movement going on, as we all remember. And I think that part of that was, you know, like everybody was, all our parents were so, you know, you got to like follow the rules and that's how our country works and all that stuff. And here you had kids in school, you know, I mean, obviously, I mean, you saw what was going on in San Francisco, but, and everybody got a piece of that, you know. I mean, we were exposed to all of that by, you know, even from Time Magazine, you'd read it about the summer of love and the hippies and all that. So you start growing your hair a little long. It was a sign of rebellion. It was like a sign of, you know, I mean, the whole thing about rock and roll, I mean, it was still suffering the rap from the 50s of the, you know, it being race music and being the devil's music and Elvis Presley with long sideburns and shaking his hips and all that stuff that went along with it. Rock and roll, you know, and Chuck Berry, I mean, God, he was black. And making this music, I mean, it scared the crap out of everybody. So, you know, all of that coming on, even the Beatles, you know, they had their nice little haircuts going on, you know, but it's still, I mean, they looked very rebellious, you know, even with those suits. I mean, give me a break. That's why when the Stones came along, they were like, they were the Antichrist, you know?
So to do something wrong and make it right was like, forget it.
And they were having all the success, getting rich, and it was like such a, you know, a snub of the nose to the establishment. So of course, you know, like for us, you know, like in owning this music and then having some hair was like really, it's pretty shocking to our parents.
I asked Aerosmith lead guitarist Joe Perry if he could recall the first song that he ever wrote with singer Steven Tyler.
Yeah, that's easy. That's like... was Moving Out. That was the first song we wrote. And the lyric was very descriptive of our life, what was going on for us, which again is very bluesy.
We all live on the edge of town, where we all live in a soul around. When nothing on the tell just again, and gotta move out, cause the city's moving in.
And that's why we got a really good singer.
That's Moving Out, the very first in a string of Steven Tyler Joe Perry songs that would span four decades. Still to come, Steven Tyler reveals a childhood as an outsider and a hurtful experience as a kid that would sow the seeds of addiction later. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the 45th anniversary of Aerosmith's debut.
Hi, this is Steven Tyler, and you're in the studio with the Bad Boys in Aerosmith.
Hey, this is Joe Perry from Aerosmith. You're in the studio.
Thanks again, guys. I'm Redbeard for Aerosmith's anniversary of their January 1973 debut. The pervasive drug abuse that would later undermine Aerosmith's success and almost snuff out several lives was at this point lurking on the horizon. But the roots of substance abuse of at least one band member, lead singer Steven Tyler, go back to adolescence.
You know, all my friends were geeks, if you want to call them geeks. You know, all the people that nowadays are, you know, presidents and CEOs and all the cool kids I want to get in with are either, you
dead.
Know, dead or some made it through. Some are policemen. I got my share. I had big lips, you know, could never have long hair. This was in grade school, of course. when this all happened, you know, fifth and sixth grade. Of course, 64, 65, I had long hair. I always tucked it in the back of my turtleneck. But I got, made fun of and called all those names. And I think that's probably one of the reasons I joined a band, was to set up in the lunchroom, you know, Friday afternoon and try to have little Susie that sat behind me in homeroom, you know, check me out. I mean, who knows?
How bad did it get? Words? Cruel words?
Yeah.
Made fun of?
Interestingly enough, Ray Tabano, who was in the band in the beginning, had this little leaflet out, you know, beware of Steve the Lip, Lipuanian Tallarico. Catch the dreaded Lipuanian disease. And as a kid, you know, that's devastating. It got as bad as it got, you know. But I was a loner, you know. I wore cowboy boots to school, and I sewed buttons on the side of them, and I put a little loop on the inside of my dungarees that would sit over the button so my pants would always go down so I wouldn't get caught having cowboy boots, and tucked my hair in. And, you know, I was a country boy. I brought my .22 to Yonkers and almost got arrested. And, you know, I mean, it was just one of those things. You know, I was an outcast, and I wanted to just be able to celebrate it.
What did you resort to when you were being made fun of? You even say in the book that you actually were what we would call beat up. You worried about that the rest of the day because you had to get up the next morning and do it again.
What did I resort to? You mean that liquid that was in the bottle that my mom kept under the sink?
At what age did you
probably start? Probably ninth grade, 16, yeah. I'd have a couple shots of Johnny Walker or whatever was under there before I went to school in the morning.
Just to try to have the guts to wait at the bus stop?
Not necessarily the guts. You got to know that, you know, we talk about all the drugs in this band. The 60s was different. Well, it's hard to say it was different. It was more a camaraderie, peace, love, baby. Vietnam War. Look what they did to the people of Kent State. The government did to us. So let's smoke some pot and all get together. I mean, everybody was getting effed up, major league. Mm-hmm. And I just took it, as I do everything, you know, to heart. Full tilt bozo. I mean, if you didn't do all the drugs that was in the room and be able to walk out, then you weren't cool. So I guess, yes, you could boil it all the way back to when I was drinking. Mm. You know, started with hard cider. The very, very first time. It was about 16, 17. Mm-hmm. 16. It stemmed from, you know, being an outcast and I was trapping. Like I said, I was a country boy.
Yeah. The irony that I get from this story is that, at least for your formative years, it seemed that you were dying to be somebody else because being yourself didn't seem to be accepted. And the irony in that is that there are millions of people around the world who fantasize about what it must be like being you. Mm. And isn't that the odd thing about life?
Major full circle right there. Yeah.
Originally done by the late Memphis soul singer Rufus Thomas. That's Aerosmith with their version of Walking the Dog from their January 1973 debut. The band had to beg, borrow, and steal to make a follow-up. Would rise throughout the 1970s, fall in the early 1980s, only to rise again to even greater heights. Or as writer David Wilde puts it, Aerosmith got it all, then they lost it all, then they got it all back again, end quote. But no final chapter has yet been written. Here's Steven Tyler.
No, that's the point. It's not over. I mean, we started as this band to try to write some songs, and it started with a couple of ditties like Dream On and Moving Out and the very first album, and then, you know, it seems today, although a lot less than before, that the world at large got caught up in the drugs, Aerosmith drugs, this and that, and Aerosmith clean as an arrow and back and sober and all that stuff. I mean, it was nonstop. And it is, if you look at it, about the music. You put the first album on, you put Toys in the Attics on, you put Rocks on, you put Permanent Vacation on, Pump, Get a Grip. It just is nonstop, and no, it's not over. Because, you know, if I was to say one thing, it's about survival. I can't tell you how many times I sat down and said, man, I'm writing a book. I'm sorry. Enough of this. I'm writing a book. Because there are, you know, there's so many people came out of the woodwork to either try to trip us up or help us along.
This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my guest, Tom Hamilton.
Joe Perry, and Steven Tyler. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Red Beard. For Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.